The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
I want to express my appreciation to you as an audience. Thank you for your good attention and just sitting back and watching. It's just nice to see people who are so keenly interested in the subject at hand. I would like for us to start with Galatians 5. We think about discipline that liberates. Here Paul talks about the Christian's liberty. And I'd like to just read verse 1 and then 13 and 14. And then I think we'll speak for a few minutes about discipline that does not liberate or cannot liberate. And then we'll try to look at some principles for liberating discipline. And at the end of that, maybe try to lay down some sort of a plan for appeal or maybe a framework for working out a personal approach or method for handling discipline situations. I feel like this is a big task as a dad. You know, I think about discipline and how difficult it is to administer properly and how hard it is to feel like you're seeing the kind of fruit from your discipline that you want. But we certainly can't give up, and the scripture gives us some principles, so we have to get at it and dig a little bit and find out what the Lord has to say. So Galatians 5, 1, and then 13 and 14. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Verse 13. For brethren, ye have been called unto liberty, only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So there's something of a framework, because Paul talks here about Christian liberty, and he says that there is a form of liberty that's inappropriate and a form that is appropriate, and we'll come back to this at a later point. But let's just jump right into talking about discipline cannot liberate. First of all, we'll talk about motives. There are motives behind discipline that frustrate the purpose of liberation. To love and to serve, as Paul says in Galatians 5, is the objective. He says in verse 13, use not your liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. So loving service is what we're after in terms of what we're liberated to as Christians. And I think what we are liberated to as Christians is what we want to liberate our students to and our children to. But there are motives that hinder that kind of liberation. Self-motives, first of all. This one that is motivated by personal distaste. My sister had a teacher when she was in the fifth grade who did not like her. And I'm not sure exactly what it was about my sister that this teacher disliked. Probably the things that I disliked in my sister. She was bossy and pushy and sometimes even downright mean. Threatened my life a few times. I did not deserve it. I did not assure you. But my sister had a teacher, Mrs. Dieter, fifth grade teacher, who really despised her. And in fact, she was so severe with my sister that one time my sister left the classroom, left the school, and ran home in tears. And we lived about 3/4 of a mile away from the school. Mrs. Dietrich, for whatever reason, did not like Karen Kennedy, and she disciplined her out of a motive of distaste. And I don't know that anybody will ever understand the reason for that kind of discipline, but it was very ineffective. And my sister was just about as stubborn and obnoxious as Mrs. Dietrich, and so they just remained head-to-head all year long until sixth grade, and I don't think anything was accomplished at all. Another motivation is impatience. I come to my limit, I get exasperated with a student, and I blow up. I fire back. That kind of discipline cannot liberate. Discipline motivated by offenses against my authority. Now, there's certainly room for expecting students to respect the teacher's authority. But if I am simply reacting to an apparent lack of respect for authority, or reacting because I have this sense that, you know, I am the authority in this classroom and people do what I say, and if they don't do what I say, well, then I just crack down on them. The discipline that results will not be a liberating discipline. It will not provide the student a means of understanding how to serve others by love. And I can think about this in terms of my own experience as a dad. There are times when my children don't respect my authority. And I can respond in any one of two ways. I can respond by feeling like I have been personally offended and I need to get this person, this child, into line in order that they have a proper respect for my authority. Or I respond by trying to understand what it is about the way that I've been exercising my authority, or the way that, in the case of a student, the way that the child normally relates to authority that's causing this kind of offense. Sometimes, for some of us, this sort of motivation may not even really fit the offense. Sometimes the teacher may feel like his or her authority is threatened, even when the students really don't intend to threaten his or her authority. But if I am motivated by this, I will not be able to exercise proper discipline. Actually, probably the right word for right here is discipline that is motivated by a desire of the teacher's heart to be popular. I guess this is a difficulty for me. I find myself more often falling into the trap of not exercising discipline in the way it ought to be exercised, not exercising discipline at all, because I don't want my students to be mad. I don't want them to dislike me. And that's a selfish motivation. And it won't lead to the students being able to be where God wants them to be by means of the exercise of discipline. Then there are institutional motivations. These motives for wrong discipline flow out of what personally is at stake for me. There are also these what I would call institutional motives. Fear of the loss of control in the classroom or at recess or wherever it may be. And again, there's a need to maintain control. But if the only reason that I'm responding to a situation with discipline is that I'm afraid if I don't discipline, things are going to get out of hand, then chances are that the nature of my discipline will be self-centered rather than other-centered. Along with that, simply trying to maintain schedule rather than trying to understand what's behind the behavior that needs to be disciplined. Now, don't get me wrong, there is a need to maintain order and to keep on schedule. But if the motivation for my discipline is just that I'm trying to make this thing work, keep this institution well-oiled and moving, then I'm not going to administer discipline that's liberating. Covering the material and fear of my superiors react, whether that's parents, physical, and whatever. Maybe you have a comment or a question.
How do you maintain friendship with your students and still communicate to them the reality that you are the one in control, that you're not equals? Wilmer's question for you.
We don't know.
Okay, so age makes a difference. Has something to do with the genuineness of your person. Right. In fact, may it not be true that the more open I am with my students, the more they will sense that I'm comfortable in my place, and I'm comfortable with them in their place, and I don't feel threatened by the fact that we might have a relationship in which they sense that I'm accessible, I'm their friend. They could even maybe correct me. A question. Any other thoughts about that? Is it right to say that my command should grow out of my relationship with them? And that gets back to what Brandon was saying. If you're whole, you're mature, you know what you ought to be. Given your stage in life and experience and grace that God's given. Okay, methods that will not lead to liberation and discipline. Methods out of place. I'll tell you a little story at this point, maybe, about college situation. I was in a Shakespeare class as an undergraduate. I was sitting in the back of the room with a couple of my friends against a wall. I leaned back in my desk chair, one of those desks with the table attached. Leaned back in that thing, leaning up against the wall with my feet on the desk in front of me. Now, this was the condition of my spiritual life, that I would sit in such a way in the classroom. I was not a Christian. And Professor Baumgarten was up in the front of the room talking about whatever it was, King Lear or Macbeth or something. And I was sitting back in the room in that posture, going like this. I knew all this, you know. So Professor Baumgarten said, "Okay, Kennedy, if you know everything there is to know about this boy, you come up here and teach us." Whoa! I turned red, needless to say, put my feet down, sat my chair with four legs on the floor, and got my pen out. Now, I don't think that that was discipline out of place. I was being obnoxious enough to him in the public domain, and he simply responded in kind. I don't think there was anything vindictive about the way that he spoke to me. He just put me on the spot. But there is a kind of discipline that's out of place, that humiliates it publicly, and will not build confidence and bridges between yourself and the student. And that kind of method will not be liberating. Inappropriate discipline is giving you a fix. Criticizing the Old Testament to see how God matched offenses and punishments. He didn't stone everybody for every offense. But there were appropriate offenses, appropriate disciplines for the offense. Sometimes it was to make retribution. Sometimes it was to make retribution plus some other charge that was exacted on top of that. I mean, to make restoration. And sometimes it was to restore something and then to get more on top of that. I think one of our maybe mistakes is to find a stop response to infractions or to irregularities in behavior, and to simply always respond to every student in every situation with the same kind of discipline. But we need to learn how to find the disciplines that are appropriate for the offenders. Methods which are without understanding of a situation. You walk into the classroom, you see somebody standing up on the top of the piano in the corner of the room, and all the other students standing around looking at them, and you explode. "What are you doing up there? Get down off that piano. Go off the hall." And then you take the student out to read him the riot act, and you discover that there was a legitimate reason, well, maybe in his mind, anyway, for him to be standing on top of the table. Discipline that's methods that are too easy or too severe. And that would be keeping the fee inappropriate in regard of the offense, in relation to the offense. Discipline that liberates does not associate or use or communicate meanings that are detached from the truth. In other words, discipline accompanied by an explanation for the discipline itself that's unclear will not be liberating, and discipline that's hypocritical. Discipline that pretends to be for the good of the student or for the protection of other students or for the protection of the institution or something else that are really motivated by some selfish purpose will not liberate. In Ephesians 6:4, Paul tells fathers not to provoke their children to wrath. And the word provoke could be translated exasperate. Don't exasperate your children. And the context there seems to be in relation to, at least partly, in relation to discipline. Don't use disciplinary measures that exasperate the one being disciplined. The word provoke or exasperate in the Greek means literally to stir up in inner strife. And the basis of the idea is the presence of conflict or tension. And I read this, I understand this, to mean something like this at least, that there are kinds of discipline that unjustly create or wrongly create tension within the one being disciplined, because the discipline is in whatever way inappropriate for the offense. And so what happens is the one who is being disciplined has part of him or her that sees a need, that recognizes the need to submit and to follow. But because the discipline is administered in the wrong way, or from the wrong motives, or without clear means, there is another part of the person who is receiving the discipline that wants justice. And this creates tension within them. And I think that's what Paul is talking about, that if you discipline in this way, or teach, or parent in this way, you create frustration. Part of me wants to obey. Part of me cannot, because you're not treating me in the way that you should treat me. And I think it also lays responsibility upon the one who disciplines for creating that frustration. And so I think Ephesians 6 is a good summary verse for us to think about in reference to discipline that will not liberate. It will place in bondage, the bondage of this kind of frustration that will struggle to submit to the discipline and find freedom. Any questions or comments about that? Or about methods, motives, and means in discipline? Okay, well, let's look at discipline that does the worry. First step is death to my own ends. That is, to my ends as an individual. If we go back to the idea of personality that we were putting forth this morning, that individuality is the enemy of personality. As long as you are expressing individuality, you make it impossible to have communication or connection with another person the way that will allow you to love each other and grow. So proper discipline must begin with death to my individuality, with my desire to assert myself, my rights, my authority, my perception of what ought to be going on in this situation or whatever. In 2 Corinthians 12, Paul makes reference to this death in his own experience with the Corinthians. I think these verses are instructive, and I'd like to just read them. In 12, 14 through 17. 2 Corinthians 12, 14. Now, Paul has been through a great deal of frustration with the Corinthians. This is probably actually his third letter to them, not his second letter. We don't have the one that probably came between 1st and 2nd Corinthians. He had sent Titus to them. He had intended to visit them a number of times in order to try and set things straight, and God had prohibited him from doing that. So, they were a discipline problem for him. And he says this, "Behold, the third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you. Why? For I seek not yours, but you." In other words, I'm not looking to benefit from you. I don't want what you've got in order to benefit me. I want you. Paul had died to his own advantage, to his own benefit. And he was looking squarely at the advantage of the Corinthians. That's what he was burdened for. And so he didn't want to be a burden to them. "For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children." Beautiful. A beautiful metaphor for Paul to use. Parents don't expect their children to bring out of their little lives, a storehouse of experience, maturity, love, and care in order to make the parents happy. But the parents do that for the children. And so Paul says, "I'm the one whom God's laid the responsibility upon. I'm the authority. I'm the apostle. So I'm not looking for you to take care of me. I'm coming to take care of you." Verse 15, "And I will very gladly spin and be spit for you. And the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved." And Paul says in chapter 13, verse 2, "I told you before and foretell you as if I were present the second time, and being absent now, write to them which heretofore have sinned, and to all other, that if I come again, I will not spare." I'm going to come, discipline. It's going to be within this context that I am going to spin myself out for you. I'm going to do everything I can possibly do for you. "Since ye seek a proof of Christ speaking in me, which to you word is not weak, but is mighty in you, for though he was crucified through weakness, yet he liveth by the power of God. For we also are weak in him, but we shall live with him by the power of God toward you." And then he asks them, "Examine yourselves whether ye be in the faith." We will go on to the next verses, but you can look at them. Paul had rightly abandoned interest in Paul. And he had interest only in the Corinthians. I had a Hebrew professor in seminary who was a fiery guy. He had a tremendous amount of energy and drive and personal persuasion. He is probably to this day dead sure that Hebrew is the language of heaven, and he was never afraid to tell you so. But I remember an incident in his classroom. Now, I'm really hanging out the dirty laundry because here we are. Now, I'm in seminary, okay? And I'm behaving this way still. I was sitting in the back row. My traditional place. I wasn't leaning back in my chair with the feet up on the desk in front of me. But I'm sitting in the back row, and Dr. Rigsby was up on the board, and he was writing some Hebrew.
happen this way, you know, because it goes from over here to over there, like Chinese.
He's writing away on the board, and he leaves a
space. And he was very particular about the way that you wrote Hebrew characters when you wrote your Hebrew, because Hebrew manuscripts have no spaces between them, and so when you're reading the Hebrew text, it's very important to be careful about making sure you mark your spaces so it's evident that you know where each word ends and where one word ends and the next word begins. But he left a little gap between two letters at the end of a word, and then he skipped a space and left a gap about the same size between the last letter of that word and the next word. So it looked like he had three letters and then a letter and then three letters or four letters in the next word. Now, Dr. Rigsby was a believer in the gap theory. You know what the gap theory is? It's the theory that between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, there was a prolonged period of time in which, I don't know, I'm not sure if that's where the dinosaurs were supposed to be or that's where Satan fell from heaven, but he was a proponent of the gap theory. So I raised my hand, and he looked at me like, why are you raising your hand? This wasn't question time. And I said, Dr. Rigsby, is that the gap? Well, he had a piece of chalk in his hand, and he reared back, and he threw that chalk at me, and it shattered on the wall about that far above my head. Now, I love Dr. Rigsby. He taught me a lot of Hebrew. But I would like to say that I do not think that at that moment he had died to his own ends. That was discipline inappropriate for the place and the offense. I'm glad he didn't hit me in the head, because I probably have a scar. To begin with, we must die to our own. There must be a sense that this self is not of primary importance. Secondly, discipline must move toward the goal of 1 Timothy 1:5. And you can turn there in your Bibles. I shared this last year. We talked about this a little bit last year. But I guess it is for me a sort of credo. So I return to it very, very often. 1 Timothy 1:5 says, the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart and of a good conscience and of faith unfeigned. In the New American Standard Version, it says, the goal of our instruction. The goal of our instruction, or the end, the finishing point, the point of maturity in our instruction, and in the King James Version, that word is commandment. The Greek is parakletos, which means a message or a teaching which is delivered. And I think the delivery part of this is important. A transmitted charge, a transmitted message, a delivered command. It's not the kind of teaching that, just takes place where you give the information and the students take it or leave it. But it's something that I bring to you. Actually, this part of this word is angel. A messenger. The angels were the people who God sent. And they got down in there and they mingled among men and they spoke to them. They spoke to Gideon and Abraham. So this is discipline that communicates. The goal of our instruction or our discipline which communicates is love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a faith unfeigned or a sincere faith. And I would suggest to you that you could set down for yourself this verse as a principle, a guideline for proper discipline. If you want to know what you should be achieving when you enter into discipline, this is what you're after. To instill in the student an ability to not instill in the student, but to build in the student, to help discipline into the student the ability to love with purity of heart, with wholeness or healthiness of conscience, and with faith that's hypocritical. Faith that doesn't pretend to be something that it's not. And of course, to be able to do this, I have to be loving that student with pure heart, good conscience, and a faith that's not hypocritical. That's what unfeigned means, unhypocritical. With my children, we have kind of taken this verse as a philosophical approach, a philosophical basis for our approach to discipline. And we seek to communicate to them what truths are necessary in any given discipline situation. And sometimes this means that we discipline, and then tomorrow or the next day or for a week afterwards, we spend time talking about the behavior and its motives that were disciplined back at that time. Now, with my children as young as they are, I wouldn't feel comfortable saying, okay, now here's an infraction. Let me go research in Scripture how to deal with this, and 3 days later come back and discipline them. But we will use our family devotion times to address issues which reoccur, and to go to the Scripture and to find principles that will enable them to learn how to purify their hearts, clear their consciences, and learn what it means not to pretend about what they believe God for in their lives. Thirdly, discipline that liberates is discipline given without extinguishing a smoldering wick. And Matthew 12:20 is the verse which this comes from. It's a verse in which Jesus quotes Isaiah, excuse me, when he had withdrawn himself from the leadership of the Jews. The Pharisees were seeking an opportunity to destroy him, and he withdrew. I'm not sure, because this is in Matthew, I'm not sure if this is the first time that he withdrew, but I kind of think that it is the first time that he separated himself to escape them. And he told the disciples, he quoted Isaiah and told the disciples this about himself. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax he shall not quench, or a smoldering wick he will not extinguish. I think what Jesus meant was he saw the frailty of Israel, that it wouldn't take much for Israel's faith to be snuffed. They were in a precarious situation. And Jesus was not ready to go head to head with the Pharisees, because to do so would have extinguished what faith was remaining. There are problem students who are like the Pharisees. who could be snuffed out. You could deal with them in such a way that you extinguish their wit. They seem to be more troublesome, more problematic than others, and the temptation may be to just snuff them out. But the problem that you see in the students may, in fact, be evidence that the student is a smoldering wick, that the student is just in a dangerous place, particularly vulnerable. I had a student, again, not in this school, but in another place, an eighth grade boy who was most of the time really very sweet. A real charming boy from a wonderful family. And I anticipated, before I began teaching school, in our school, I anticipated enjoying getting to know this student. But he didn't really want to be in school. He was there because his dad was forcing him to be there. And he was the most athletically capable student. He was head and shoulders taller than all the other boys in the class. He was witty. He was handsome. He was beginning to be interested in what the girls thought about him. And whatever combination of things in addition to that produced in this boy a sort of flippancy and disrespect that really became a problem in the classroom. So I would be over here teaching the 9th and 10th graders, and I'd look over there, and here's this boy writing on the wall, or writing on his desk. Or all of a sudden, he'd get up and walk out. Go to the bathroom. Well, my first strategy, it's always my first strategy, someday I'll learn, was to begin to exercise discipline, you know, demerits. Well, that made the problem worse. He rebelled. He tore him up. He threw him in the trash can. Never in front of my face, but always in front of the other students. In front of the students. Well, to make a long story short, the strategy that I chose with this boy, I chose because I sensed that a conflict was between me and I, a contest of wills, was not going to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish and what God wanted to accomplish in his life. And so instead, I pursued essentially the strategy that Melvin was articulating. We went head-to-head in softball, head-to-head in basketball. We played hard. We talked a lot. I spent lunch with him. I befriended him. And he changed. Now, that won't always happen. But I believe this boy was a smoldering wick. There were problems at home. There were problems with his transition in life. And he did not need to be cracked down. He needed to be loved. He needed to be understood and sympathized. Well, time's often passed, and there's more here, but finally, a plan of appeal. There are some verses there which just give evidence of this, that there's a biblical precedent for having a plan for discipline. These are church-related scriptures, not school-related scriptures, but still the principle is there. There should be a plan. You should know, you should have a method for going about discipline. And I'll just say a couple things about this. Don't wait until you're reacting to try and find a means of discipline, observe and try to develop methods of appeal to students. Talk to the offender. Hear him out. Try to understand what was happening. If you need to wait to decide the proper means of discipline, wait. And explain to the student that you need time. I don't know if that's appropriate or not. The school says, I suppose it would depend on the grade level. I would have to do that in some circumstances. Well, I've exceeded my time, and I will stop. Thank you. Any questions? Yeah, that didn't happen in my classroom. And I feared that question. What happened was all the students saw what was going on. They understood the nature of that student's behavior. And they also knew that I was not doing nothing about it. And there were times when I called him out. And we went into the bathroom and talked. Maybe someone else has some thoughts about that. I do understand what you're saying. And I think in that there was a bit of a risk in the way that I handled it. And there was just a little bit of sort of intuition and much prayer meet my way. Any thoughts about that? Something else to add? Maybe caution. Thank you.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.